This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, Attorney General Jeff Sessions has recently announced plans to increase the use of civil forfeiture.
That is to say, they want to accelerate the process by which poor people are being ripped off.
Gregory Wilpert joins us from Caracas, Venezuela, to talk about the situation happening there.
There's a lot of misinformation in the U.S. press where the head of the government, Maduro, is characterized as a dictator and that they're causing all kinds of violence. This is not the truth. Give a listen.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. Michael, as it seems to be a weekly occurrence, there's been yet another shakeup in the White House, and the chief of staff is now a Marine general.
Retired John Kelly.
Right.
And he's not going to stand for any nonsense, this Marine general. First thing he did was he fired Anthony Scaramucci, and Roger Cohn had a brilliant op-ed in the New York Times last week, which we'll link to, about the Scaramucci. It turns out the Scaramucci is a stock character in 16th century Italian comedy. The Commedia dell'arte is a form of comic art that the Italians developed hundreds of years ago, and they have these comic figures. A Scaramucci is a common figure, and this is the guy's name.
It's a great name.
And he was appointed by Trump as the director of communications. Much to his wife's dismay, he had angled for the job for months and finally won it. And he's a foul-mouthed braggart and an obsequious Trump supporter. So he gives an interview to a New Yorker columnist. It was on the record. So the columnist writes up what the guy said, which was extremely disgusting. And General Kelly told Trump, unless you fire this guy, I'm not going to be your chief of staff. So Roger Cohn writes this whole story up. And there's one paragraph where he describes Trump, which I thought was pitch perfect. Would you mind reading it?
What but some profound sense of inadequacy could explain the neediness and the nastiness, the pout and the pettiness, the vanity and the vulgarity, the anger and the aggression? This president gets off on the humiliation of others. He is inhabited by some deep violence to which self-control is a stranger. It is almost painful to watch the degree to which he pursues self-aggrandizement. He confounds masculinity and machismo. As J.K. Rowling put it in a tweet, "You tiny, tiny, tiny little man." But Michael, I want to add that what bothers me is that when Scaramucci began this new job and the shortly held job, everyone was saying in the media, oh, it's a touch of New York. You know, he brings that New York style to Washington, D.C. And I feel he's giving New Yorkers a bad name.
Really, the style he brought was an extremely vulgar creep with a Brooklyn accent. The guy was awful. And his wife, recognizing his awfulness, 5 hours after he got the job, she divorced him.
Yeah, well, he wouldn't be there when she was giving birth. I mean,
oh, I didn't know
yeah,
that.
Yeah,
yeah. Yeah, yeah. No, it's as I tell you, if it wasn't so terrible, it would be funny. I remember when Trump was running, he had been the owner of the Worldwide Wrestling Federation.
Right.
And I saw a clip on him. They got one of these wrestlers. They strapped him to a chair in the center of the wrestling rink. Guy had long blonde hair. And Trump comes into the rink wearing a tuxedo with an electric shaver in one hand. And while this guy is strapped to the chair, Trump humiliates him by shaving all his hair off. And I thought to myself, what kind of a sick, sadistic, nasty guy would humiliate somebody like that? And now we see him playing it out in American politics. Last week, he issued an order without even telling the Defense Department, banning all transsexuals, of which there may be 3,000 to 11,000 in the military, telling them they're not welcome in the military. And then the next day, he spoke to the chiefs of police out in Suffolk County in Long Island, and he encouraged them to beat people up. The Defense Department rebuked Trump and said it wouldn't do it until they got a proper order, and the head of the chiefs of police said that they obey the law. But Trump is a nasty, inadequate person, as Roger Cohn describes it, and I think that you listeners will like reading the op-ed that Cohn wrote. And like I say, we'll link to it.
Got a story I wanna tell somebody. In my life I've seen a lot of things go down. I was the third brother of five.
Controversial and antiquated civil forfeiture procedures across the nation are causing many, including the country's poorest, to have their assets seized by law enforcement agencies to fill department coffers. In 2016, the manager of a Burmese Christian rock band had just completed a five-month tour cross-country, raising over $50,000 for an orphanage in Thailand and a college in Burma, when police pulled him over for a broken taillight. A routine traffic stop soon turned into a months-long nightmare. After a drug dog allegedly alerted to the car, police searched it but found no evidence of drugs. They did, however, seize the cash donations as supposed drug proceeds. After interrogating the band manager for 6 hours, the police eventually let him go, but kept the cash. Within a month, the Muskogee County District Attorney filed a civil forfeiture action to keep the money permanently. In light of Attorney General Sessions' announcement that he plans to increase the use of civil forfeiture, we can expect many more cases like this one. Joining us to talk about civil forfeiture and some reform efforts in Nebraska and New Mexico is Josie Duffy Rice. She is an attorney and writer in New York and is also research director of the Fair Punishment Project. Josie, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, we've done several segments over the past few years on issues related to civil forfeiture, but how would you describe the downsides of this practice?
I would say that there's nothing but downsides to civil forfeiture. When the government is willing to, and law enforcement is willing to take property from people who have not been charged with a crime, much less convicted, you have a system where you are being forced to give up property for something you didn't do wrong, or haven't been proven to do wrong yet. I mean, that's the real problem with civil asset forfeiture. It's being punished for... what's the phrase that I'm trying to think of?
Innocent until proven guilty.
You're supposed to be innocent until proven guilty. And when with civil asset forfeiture, I mean, it's one of the things in law enforcement we see where you're actually guilty, assumed to be guilty before anything has been filed.
Exactly. And really, mostly unable to go before a judge. A lot of these are administrative proceedings.
Yes.
How difficult is it to get a person's property or money back after it's been seized? What obstacles are there?
Well, in civil asset forfeiture, often the burden of proof is on the person who's had their assets seized and not actually on the law enforcement. So you have to take time out of your day, take money, take space, and go and try to prove or demonstrate that this piece of property, whether it be your car, your house, money, was not used for criminal purposes and advancement of a crime. And depending on how bad law enforcement wants to keep your property, which, spoiler alert, it's usually very, very badly that they want to keep your property, it can take months, it can take years to get, you know, something that you worked hard for back. It's very difficult when the burden of proof is on the citizen or the resident versus the government.
Especially when the person whose assets have been seized may not have resources
to mount
legal defense.
Are you telling me that you have to prove a negative?
You have to prove a negative.
How do you prove a negative?
Right. I mean, this is the fundamental, and this is one of the fundamental tenets of our criminal justice system, right, is that the burden of proof should be on the state. That is supposed to be how this system works. But when in a civil system, which is normally just you and I going back and forth in court, not me going against the government, the burden of proof is different. And the evidence standard is different. And so what we're seeing is that in criminal cases, civil rules are applied to criminal cases. And that's an abuse of government power.
Yeah.
It's a real abuse of law enforcement power.
Yeah, in criminal cases, there's a higher burden beyond a reasonable doubt.
Beyond a reasonable doubt. And that you would imagine that would be the burden of proof if your assets are forfeited because you have supposedly been engaged in a criminal enterprise. But that's not the case.
Josie, talk, if you will, about the racial implications in this practice of civil forfeiture.
Absolutely. So the people that tend to have their things taken are the people who won't fight back. I mean, there are cases where drug gangs have millions of dollars taken, you know, seized. But in reality, the everyday practice of civil forfeiture is taking from people who can't fight back. And so often, that's people of color, that's poor people. You know, their studies have shown that it's people of color are way more likely to have their assets taken than white people. What you see is it's a replication of a pattern we see all the time in law enforcement, which is it is a power balance, a power dynamic, and that law enforcement tends to abuse that power around with people, with communities that have sort of historically been disenfranchised, historically had to deal with tough law enforcement, historically had to deal with unfair law enforcement practices.
Josie, it's my understanding that if local law enforcement gets involved in a federal forfeiture action, they're actually paid kind of a bounty by the feds for participating.
Right, right. So there's the thing called the Equitable Sharing Program, which at its most simple means that local law enforcement can seize, in many cases, local property and work with the federal government, or can find local property, work with the federal government to seize it, and take some of the profits of the actual seizure. So in the Equitable Sharing Program, often, you know, the benefit to it is that in some states, when you seize assets, all the money may go into a general fund, or it may go to a lot of different agencies. With the federal program, the money ends up going back to the law enforcement agencies directly. So you're more likely to get a bigger share of that money. And what we see is that, you know, the federal government is helping local law enforcement sort of take people's property all of the time by helping them seize it, taking a large portion of the actual seizure profits, but then giving another portion of that back to the states, back to the localities.
It's funny. A friend recently showed me a website called propertyroom.com, which is jewelry, watches, cars, seized by the government that people bid on. And so I guess that when cash is given directly to either local or federal law enforcement, and we're talking not just police departments, but the Drug Enforcement Agency, Immigration, ICE, the IRS, Department of Homeland Security, all of these law enforcement agencies profit from these forfeitures. But on propertyroom.com, and I'm sure there are many other sites like that, I guess that's how they turn the property into dollars that then goes to the departments. But how can these agencies be impartial in enforcing the law if their own budgets perhaps are strained and they're trying to get a piece of the pie? It's sort of like after 9/11, pots of money were available for local law enforcement you could apply to DHS. Right. You had to show there were terrorist threats in your area. So isn't that a problem?
Yes, and it really does. I mean, civil forfeiture there are so many problems with it. And one problem with it is what you just said, that we have a law enforcement system that in many places is strained, doesn't have enough money to actually carry out day-to-day practices, and that goes for the local prosecutor's office. It goes for the local police. And what it means is they end up having to make money off of people's backs, right? You see it in bail. You see it all the time with fees and fines. Constantly, if you're involved in the criminal justice system, and with civil forfeiture, I mean, that's even an exaggeration, right? Your kid may be involved in the criminal justice system, your neighbor, some guy borrowed your car, and now they're saying they need to take your car because that guy maybe one day had drugs. The connection is so tenuous. And what we're seeing is it's just another example of law enforcement at best trying to make up for budgetary constraints, at worst trying to make a couple extra bucks left and right. Either way, that's not the average citizen's responsibility to be, you know, funding law enforcement through illegal actions because they don't have enough money to do it themselves.
I understand that in a recent poll, 84% of Americans indicated they oppose civil forfeiture. And even Justice Clarence Thomas recognized in a concurring Supreme Court opinion that, quote, forfeiture operations frequently target the poor and other groups least able to defend their interests, mm-hmm. as you've explained. Why do you think Attorney General Sessions has recently called for reinstatement of civil forfeiture? What's his rationale?
Well, I mean, I would argue that Attorney General Sessions is constantly doing things that pull badly. He is fundamentally a very big believer in law enforcement. And what law enforcement would say is the reason for civil forfeiture. It stops people from committing crimes. It helps fund the kind of big investigations, the big actions that we need. It takes the actual stuff that's being taken away is from people who have done serious wrongs. The reality is that there are such horror stories about civil forfeiture. There was one I was reading today about parents who had their house seized when their child was charged with $40 possession of heroin. I mean, their house was taken. You know, I don't know that Attorney General Sessions could justify that. I don't know how he could. Now, he may be able to say the entire practice, in theory, has some benefits. And I don't think that that's actually how it plays out on the ground. But that's the argument he would make. And that's the argument that law enforcement would make. And you can imagine that if you're getting millions of dollars a year from a practice that's ostensibly legal, you're going to find a way to justify it. Yeah. I spend a lot of time talking to bail bond companies, and they do this, you know, the same sort of logic of, well, if we don't do this, then how are we going to keep the streets safe? Or, you know, there's a lot of self-justification that happens in the law enforcement parties and the parties that kind of surround it.
Yeah, I had another horror story that I'll share with you.
Yes, please.
Of an attorney up in the Catskills who had a little summer house up there, and there was a helicopter overflight, and they saw that the guy was growing a marijuana plant, and they got his house.
Right.
I mean, I guess you read about stories like that all the time.
I'm always just surprised, and I mean, I'm shocked. There was a great New York article about this about 4 years ago, and people will be driving. This was in a small town in Texas. People are driving through the town with their families on the way to vacation. The cops stop them, and they say, we have evidence, or we suspect you're transferring drugs, or you've transferred drugs in this car, or we smell marijuana on you. And they take their car. You know, they just take their car. You're on vacation with your family. And the next day, your kids are in the car, you know. And then, people are not prepared for the fact that this is actually possible. It seems so unbelievable.
But they're trying to reform this practice in New Mexico, Nebraska.
They have.
Talk to us about that.
So both New Mexico and Nebraska have outlawed civil asset forfeiture. They have gotten rid of it. What they have done now is that you have to be convicted of a crime to have your property taken. And I don't want to get too in the weeds, but with civil asset forfeiture, it basically means that the government is bringing is an action against a thing, right? They're not saying to the parents of the kid who had $40 of heroin, they're not saying, we think you committed a crime, so we're taking your property. They say, we think a crime was committed on this property, in this property, etc. So we're taking the property, and all we have to show and maybe not even show, is a preponderance of the evidence that a crime could have been committed in this property. With criminal asset forfeiture, when to actually have something taken because of in an actual criminal case against a person, you're bringing a charge against a person. You need to prove theoretically that beyond a reasonable doubt this person committed a crime, and that the actual property is seized sort of in tandem with the person versus in on its own with the thing. That might feel a little vague and intangible, but the reason that it matters is that it's very easy to say that a piece of property could have been connected to something along the way. That's a very, very low standard to prove. And it's a very different story. I mean, there are arguments that even criminal forfeiture is very abused, but it's not abused in the same way that civil forfeiture is. And at least you need a conviction, right? Right now, you don't even need a charge.
Right. And part of the problem, I guess a large part, is that these are administrative proceedings. They're not before a judge, so the standards are different.
Right. I mean, there are different kinds of proceedings, but often they are administrative. They're in civil practice and not criminal. And, you know, they happen sort of under the radar. And this happens so much in law enforcement, right? You know, my dream is to just get someone to sit in a court, every court in America, all day long, so I could just get an actual sense of what's happening, because it's very difficult to follow these cases. You know, a lot of people who are having their stuff taken, maybe it's $1,000, but you make $25,000 a year and you have three kids. And so it's hard to get the local newspaper to care about $1,000, or it's hard to spend a lot of time on that because you have other stuff to do. So many of these stories are not even told. You're not even seeing them.
I was struck in the story that we mentioned in our introduction was about a manager of a band that had gone on tour to raise money to give for charitable purposes, and he had all the money they raised in cash in the car. And during a routine traffic stop, the officer said that a dog had sniffed and alerted them there might be drugs. And so they seized the cash.
Right.
As you say, it's sort of like on the property. And that reminds us of a segment we did a while back on how small businesses who deal primarily in cash transactions have been targeted as well.
Yep.
And
yeah,
that's, again, businesses that can't afford to charge everything hits those. We were interested, Josie, in the Fair Punishment Project. If you could tell us a bit about its work, and if you don't mind, how you came to be involved in this.
Yeah, so I was previously a journalist who covered mostly prosecutors. And I came to the Fair Punishment Project because of the groups, you know, they sort of lead the way in prosecutor-related research on prosecutor-related issues as related to criminal justice. So we do a lot of things. We have some excellent journalists on staff who we work with to kind of tell the big stories. Karima Towns is the one who told the story on civil forfeiture in New Mexico and Nebraska. And we work with law fellows and legal scholars to actually look into sort of the practices of prosecutors across the nation. So we spend a lot of time looking at who's violating evidence laws, who is locking people up for high amounts of bail when they don't deserve it, who is finding excuses to lock up kids, who is putting kids, you know, sentencing kids to life without parole for something they did as a juvenile, who is punishing poverty. And this is another example, not necessarily of punishing poverty, but using people's property and their money to kind of put them in a constant cycle of punishment. And what we are a project between Harvard Law School, the Bronx Defenders, and the Accountable Justice Collaborative. And we have some really excellent people on staff doing really, really excellent work. And so it's really been an honor for me to work there. I just started 6 months ago, but I love it so far.
And how did you come to be interested in social justice and the law?
Oh, I like that question. Before I went to law school, I worked at the Bronx Defenders, at the Public Defender's Office, and I was the assistant to the executive director, Robin Steinberg, who kind of, you know, started the Bronx Defenders 20 years ago with sort of a vision of what public defense could really look like. And I, you know, I I had been interested in criminal justice as a general term, but I didn't really know the specifics. And I remember going there the first day and walking by the courthouse and seeing the long line of people who could have been working, who had kids, who, you know, had these court dates, that you could just see that this, how much influence and what a burden the criminal justice system was on the South Bronx community. You could see it with your eyes all the time. And not to pit public defender's offices against each other. The Bronx Defenders is just one of the most incredible places I've ever seen. I'm very glad I went there so early because it meant to me that criminal justice reform had to be the focus of my life. And now, you know, in this new era with Attorney General Sessions at the helm, how we treat people in prison or people in the criminal justice system is really just an indication of what we're willing to do to everybody. It really is about civil liberties. It really is about justice. It really is about what, as a country and as a state, we believe, what rights we believe that people are entitled to. And, you know, civil asset forfeiture is an example of the fact that we live in a place where law enforcement is willing to take your stuff without charging you of a crime. That's considered acceptable. And to me, that's not just a problem for everybody who may actually have their stuff taken. It's a problem for me. I've never had my stuff taken, but it opens up the world of possibilities of what could happen to any of us at any second. And to me, that just stands against what this country is supposed to stand for. So now I'm in it. I can't get out. I'm stuck.
You're in it.
Be doing this work forever.
We're talking with Attorney Josie Duffy Rice of the Fair Punishment Project. How do people get a hold of the project if they want to?
So we are on Twitter, which is a big thing for us. We're very excited. We're at Fair Punishment. You can always reach out to me. My email is josie.duffy, D-U-F-F-Y, .rice@fairpunishment.com. And we and all of our research and all of our reports are on at fairpunishment.org. Our goal is to do a couple of things. We want to know about these issues. When people have stories of assets being seized, when they have stories of the local prosecutor abusing power or maybe doing excellent work and think they need to be highlighted, when they have stories of their son or their student or their cousin going through a process that just to them is such a reflection of how unjust the system is, those are stories we want to hear. We want to know. I mean, there are 2,300 prosecutors in America, so we can't keep really great tabs on there. We have 25 people on staff, so we do the best we can, but we really do rely on the general public and people who are actually in the system to tell us what's actually going on.
Josie, it's really been a pleasure to meet you and to have you on Law and Disorder.
Yes, thank you.
We'd
this
like
is great.
To have you on again.
I'd love to.
You reminded me of that famous quote from Clarence Darrow, that there's no justice in the courthouse or outside of it.
Yes. Yeah, we're working on it. Well, I keep telling my husband, I'm like, by the time, in 50 years, I will stop talking about this all the time. By then, I'm sure everything will be figured out. It's a nice spot, at least.
Well, Josie, thank you for your commitment and have a wonderful day.
Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Thank you, Josie.
Bye-bye. Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
American historical figure Simón Bolívar, known as the Liberator, famously said that the United States seems destined by Providence to plague America with misery in the name of liberty. The current situation in Venezuela seems to be a case in point. The country's foreign minister Samuel Moncada and Carlos Ron, an official at the Venezuelan embassy, have recently accused Florida Senator Marco Rubio and CIA Director Mike Pompeo of secretly conspiring to overthrow the democratically elected government of Nicolas Maduro. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson last week called for Maduro to step down. The United States has a history of causing regime change to governments in Central and Latin America that it doesn't like. These include the governments of Guatemala, Brazil, the Dominican Republic, Bolivia, Grenada, Chile, Panama, Argentina, Nicaragua, and Cuba, where regime change is written into American law. There has recently been a wave of violence in Venezuela, including assassinations, violence at demonstrations, and destruction of property. To speak with us about the situation in Venezuela is Gregory Wilpert, who has a Ph.D. in sociology from Brandeis University. He lived in Caracas, Venezuela, and is now based in Quito, Ecuador. He's the author of Changing Venezuela by Taking Power, The History and Policies of the Chavez Government. As a journalist, he is the founder of VenezuelaAnalysis.com. He is married to Carol Delgado Aria, who has served the Venezuelan government as ambassador to Ecuador and consul general in New York City. He is currently visiting Caracas and joins us from there.
Gregory Wilpert, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me.
What is the extent of Venezuela's current wave of extreme right-wing violence and destruction?
Well, it's been quite extensive, really. I mean, we're talking about, first of all, the protests themselves seek out violence, really. I mean, today, for example, they're planning a protest to the city center, which normally, you know, if they do organize a demonstration, and there have been plenty that have been completely peaceful, but when they organize them to the city center, that's a different story, because in the past, they've started attacking and firebombing, that is, throwing Molotov cocktails at government buildings.
Gregory, is this the opposition you're talking about?
Yes, yes. So the opposition has organized these demonstrations to the city center, where they started fires against government buildings. And so the city mayor's office decided you're no longer allowed to demonstrate in the city center. But they've been ignoring that prohibition. And so, of course, there's clashes then with the police, because they're trying to prevent them from going into the center. And then that's where the injuries occur, and sometimes death. But the thing is, the international media usually portrays this as being deaths caused all by the police, but that's absolutely not true. Actually, a minority of the deaths have been caused by the police. Most of them have been actually been caused by the demonstrators themselves. And this is borne out even by the figures of the Attorney General, who has thrown her support now on the side of the opposition. So, I mean, these are numbers that are coming directly from the opposition-sympathizing Attorney General. So over 120 people have been killed, basically, in the past 4 or 5 months from these demonstrations. And actually the worst violence has been, for example, these street blockades. When people try to remove the blockades, they get shot out from the buildings, or they get objects, rocks and bottles thrown at them, and so that they don't remove the street blockades. And that's where actually a huge chunk of the violence happens, and the injuries and deaths. And actually, just last week, actually, well, not last week, it was earlier this week, I think it was on Monday, they placed a bomb in one of the major squares, and just as a police motorcade was passing by, they detonated it, and 8 police officers were seriously injured from the explosion. So, I mean, there's just all kinds of things going on that are completely ignored or distorted, I think, by the way they're reported in international media.
Exactly. Gregory, I was going to ask, how is the violence reported on in the mainstream media?
Most of the time, they don't say at all who's responsible, so it always makes it look like it's the government. In other words, for example, they'll say something like, oh, a demonstration today happened, and there were clashes with the police, and 5 people were killed, or whatever, or 2 people were killed. And that always makes it sound like it was the police that killed them, and that's just not true. I mean, that's usually the implication, or the way people tend to read it. Then the article itself almost never actually delves into who was responsible for the injuries or the death.
And Gregory, who does support the violence and destruction, and what are its aims?
Well, that's the thing, is that this is really a calculated move, I think. That is to provoke the violence, and they know that they can count on international media and the government of the United States and other right-wing governments around the world to completely ignore the fact that the opposition is causing most of this violence, and so that, in other words, it makes the government look bad. This is really a very calculated effort, I think, to provoke the violence, blame or implicitly blame the government in order to discredit the government, and you know then you lead, have things such as the sanctions. Of course, there's more behind that, but besides the violence, but that's a major contributing factor to make it look like the government is a dictatorship.
Has there been an effort to isolate Venezuela diplomatically and economically?
The main effort has been happening through from the U.S. government, and then through the Organization of American States. Now, on the level of the Organization of American States, they have pretty much failed because you need a significant majority to pass any kinds of sanctions against a member country. However, in the U.S. Congress and the Trump administration, and even already starting with Obama, have passed various sanctions against Venezuelan government officials, but none that affect the country as a whole so far. Well, that's not quite true. They have also made it more difficult for Venezuela to obtain international loans. And so that has certainly had an effect on its credit rating, which in turn has an effect on how much they have to pay in interest whenever they do get a loan. But other than that, the U.S. efforts to isolate Venezuela have by and large failed, and they've had relatively little economic impact so far, except for the issue of the loans.
Gregory, can you talk about the program of the Nicolas Maduro government?
Well, the program has been very hampered, of course, because of all of this conflict. This takes two different levels. There's the political crisis and there's the economic crisis. And both of these have seriously impeded any kind of coherent policy program on the part of the government. He's been able to continue the policy or the legacy of Chavez, meaning mainly the social programs, the educational programs, welfare programs, et cetera, those kinds of things, and then the kind of more political programs of the communal councils and the communes. All of those have continued, but they haven't really been, expanded or anything like that. And, of course, in the context of the political and economic crisis, there have been difficulties in implementing or continuing all of them the way they were under Chavez. The main kind of program that Maduro has now pushed is really the two things, actually. On the social level is the housing program, where they've constructed something like 2 million new homes, which is really a tremendous increase, actually, over what happened during public housing. It's a tremendous increase over what Chavez did. The other main initiative that Maduro started is this constitutional reform, convoking a constitutional assembly. And we can talk more in detail about it, but the main motivation there was to provide a platform for dialoguing, really, and for involving the opposition in one way or another in order to stop the violence. That didn't quite pan out as planned because they boycotted the plan, but there's still the idea that this constitutional reform will restructure and solidify, basically, the gains of the Chavez period.
What does the opposition stand for?
Well, that's a huge problem for them, is that they haven't really defined themselves in many ways. And it's one of the reasons why the opposition continues to have real problems with their own level of support. So even though the Maduro government's popularity has declined somewhat, the opposition's isn't really much greater because they're internally very divided and they have not presented a clear plan as to what they would do differently. And so this has been a real problem for them. Though from various statements of individual leaders, that doesn't really constitute a coherent program, but it seems pretty clear that they would head in a neoliberal direction of privatizing, austerity, and dismantling the direct democratic forms of the communal councils and communes. That's almost certain. And one of the biggest fears, of course, on the Chavista side, that what they would do is engage in an active persecution of anyone who is involved in the Chavez government. And that's, of course, making it very difficult for any kinds of, say, compromise between the two sides, because there's a real fear that any kind of compromise could lead to persecution on the part of the opposition if they gain power.
Opponents of Maduro, including those on the left, have pointed out that he canceled regional elections scheduled for December of last year, that he prevented a recall referendum, and that he neutralized the National Assembly. Has he lost legitimacy?
No. I mean, first of all, you know, like I said, the government still enjoys between 25% and 30% support, which is far more than and many other governments, conservative governments in the region. I mean, if you look at Brazil, Mexico, Colombia, their presidents all have between 5 and 15% support. I mean, that's just in terms of popularity, but in terms of the legal kind of legitimacy, one would have to address each one of these points that you just mentioned individually. For example, the regional elections were never canceled; they were postponed because of the whole process of the recall referendum was taking so much time and energy and effort from the part of the Electoral Council, and also there was a process of recertifying the political parties. And so it was postponed for a year. Now, this has happened before in Venezuela. It's not without precedent. And they're scheduled now for December of this year. And they're definitely happening in December. I mean, the president has confirmed this, and actually some of the opposition parties have said that they're going to participate. So this is definitely happening. In terms of the recall referendum, that's a little bit more complicated. In the first time there was a recall referendum in 2004 against President Chavez, it took more or less 10 months to organize between the initial stage of initiating it until it actually happened, and so the Electoral Council, presented has a schedule that makes it well known that it takes roughly 10 months. However, the opposition didn't start the process until April or so of 2016. And that means that once the process, if it succeeds with collecting enough signatures and everything, then the election the referendum wouldn't have happened until sometime in January or February. And that is, that would have missed the deadline that they had, because if it happens after January of 2017, then the vice president would take over if the president is recalled, and that the opposition didn't want. So they really kind of shot themselves in the foot, because they realized, or at least the CNE, the Electoral Council, didn't make it happen before these 10 months were up, and so then they basically abandoned it because they didn't want the vice president to take over if they were to succeed in removing.
Greg, let me just ask you this on the question of legitimacy. The New York Times last Monday had a screaming front page headline about how two mayors were arrested in the middle of the night and that the country is moving towards a dictatorship. What was your reaction to that?
Well, I mean, I can't even count how many times I've heard this moving towards dictatorship. And they've been saying that ever since Chavez was first elected in 1998. So we're talking about almost a 20-year process in which this kind of headline has been appearing over and over again. And secondly, the two people who were arrested, they were actually already under arrest. They were under house arrest, and they clearly violated the terms of their house arrest. And now, one could, of course, ask, well, why were they under house arrest? But just to answer the first part, they violated the terms of their house arrest because they made clear political statements calling for military intervention and basically a coup in Venezuela, and they certainly can't do that. You certainly can't do that when you're under house arrest under a charge that's similar to that in the first place. So they were taken back to prison. And the reason that they were arrested in the first place, actually, and convicted, was because both of them had been involved in supporting and organizing violent protests in the past. Matter of fact, one of them had been found with a whole cache of weapons that seemed to be intended to use for a coup attempt, and the other had supported violent protest that led to 43 deaths back in 2014.
That's just extraordinary, Gregory, because the New York Times neglected to report what you've just told us. So let me ask you this. Do you think the majority of the population want Maduro to finish his term?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, yes. I mean, there was a poll by one of the most respected polling that supports the opposition, so it's not a government-affiliated poll, that I can't remember now what the exact numbers were, but I think it was something like 60 or 65% of the population wants Maduro to finish out his term, even though in terms of their support for Maduro, you know, it's around, like I said, something like between 25 and 30%. So, I mean, people generally in Venezuela have a very strong respect for, you know, democratic procedures and want the country to abide by those. But the opposition, the organized opposition that is the leadership, is not interested in those kinds of procedures, really. They want Maduro to leave as soon as possible, and they're receiving the full backing of the United States government. And, you know, by fact of the way the situation is being reported, they're receiving the full support of international media. And so that's a real problem because, you know, that's not what most people want.
What would it mean if the opposition came to power in an illegal and violent transition?
I think it would be horrific because, like I said before, the temptation on the part of the opposition to engage in persecution of Chavistas would be enormous. And we've seen that already back in the 2002 coup attempt. When, you know, for 2 days, for 48 hours, they were in power, and they did. There were something like 60 people killed on the streets for protesting. That's in just 2 days, and a number of government officials were rounded up and thrown into jail without any kind of due process. Now, there's no reason to believe that wouldn't happen again. I think the biggest danger, aside from all of the other political and economic implications for the rest of the population.
There was a recent election for Constituent Assembly. Can you talk about that, please, Gregory?
Yes. And like I said earlier, that this assembly, Constituent Assembly, was an idea to kind of force the opposition to deal with the government on a political level. Now, unfortunately, the opposition has refused to participate and boycotted it. But now it kind of serves some other purposes, I think. One purpose is certainly to solidify the gains of the Bolivarian Revolution. By that I mean to put the social programs and the forms of direct democracy, such as the communal councils and the communes, onto a constitutional level, so that even if the opposition comes into office, let's say in next year, you know, presidential elections would happen in October of 2018. If they do come into office, then it wouldn't be so easy for them to get rid of those gains of the Bolivarian Revolution. And so that's, I think, one of the main purposes. The other one, I think, is also a bit of a bargaining chip. That is, if there were to be negotiations between the government and the opposition, they can, and since the opposition really doesn't want this constitutional assembly, and, you know, the government could offer that as a possible, you know, bargaining chip in order to stop the violence and the economic sabotage that the opposition is currently engaging in.
So in both Argentina and Brazil, progressive governments have been ousted. Neoliberal governments have put in their place. Do you see any kind of trend in Latin America? You think the United States is encouraged by what's gone on there in the last several years?
Yes, I definitely think there's a trend, a backlash basically against the leftist governments that had been in office, you know, since in the early 2000s. In some countries, it's more successful than others, and for different reasons. Each country is, you know, a little bit unique, but by and large, it's just like when the leftist governments were encouraged. When there was this wave of leftist governments, you know, each subsequent election kind of encouraged the election of another one. Well, now you have the opposite trend, although they're not necessarily always by elections, such as in Venezuela and Brazil. There haven't been any elections, but the conservatives have kind of perceived an upwind of opportunity, and therefore were able to remove Dilma Rousseff. partly also because of the win in Argentina that the conservatives had there. Of course, same thing with Venezuela. The opposition sees an opportunity, partly because of the weakness of the Maduro government and also because of the support that they can see coming, you know, on an international level.
Speaking of which, you anticipated my next question, Gregory Wilpert. With respect to Cuba, what is their position on Venezuela, and how long have they held that position?
Well, Cuba, since the beginning, has been very supportive of the Chavez government and also of Maduro, and has been very much, you know, in strong solidarity with the movements. And, there's been no change at all in that respect. Of course, the opposition tries to use it to its advantage in the sense of saying that, that this proves that Venezuela is, a Castro communist dictatorship and whatnot. As a matter of fact, even Senator Marco Rubio on Monday, I think, gave a 10-minute address to the Venezuelan public on one of the private television stations. Well, this completely contradicts the notion that there's no freedom of speech in Venezuela, because he had free access to this television station, where he essentially tried to tie again the Venezuelan government to the governments of Cuba and Nicaragua, saying this is typical, the problems that you're facing is typical of socialist communist governments, et cetera, et cetera. In some ways, he might be right in the sense that they receive a lot of international and economic opposition, and that does lead to problems within the country. But, of course, the situations are all completely different, and the situation that Venezuela is going through right now, I don't think is, connected to socialism per se, as Rubio and others have tried to claim.
Gregory, how can our listeners best follow the unfolding situation in Venezuela?
Well, I actually launched a website about 15 or so years ago called VenezuelaAnalysis.com. So that's certainly, that's in English. I think that's very important. It's Venezuela Analysis with one A between the two words. And we have, something like four or five reporters here in Venezuela who, daily report on what's going on, and it's completely reader funded and no government support whatsoever, but it's in a perspective or in solidarity with the Bolivarian movement, that is not necessarily with the government, although the website believes that the government right now is the best way to preserve the legacy and the gains of the Bolivarian movement. But it's not, that's the main angle, is support with the social movement, not with the government. Other sources, one that's of course much more in English, that's very closely affiliated with the government of Venezuela, is Telesur English, for which I worked for a while. And then, the one that I currently work with is The Real News, TheRealNews.com, where we, Venezuela is not an exclusive focus, but we do cover it regularly.
Gregory Wilpert, if you had to put in a nutshell the gains of the Bolivarian Revolution in Venezuela, what would you say?
Well, the first thing I would say is that it made an important advance in terms of reversing policies of neoliberalism. Chavez came into office at the height of this wave of neoliberal policies, in which privatization and austerity and so on were kind of in vogue throughout the world. And it showed that, of course, people say that he was only able to do that because of Venezuela's oil wealth. Now, there's some truth to that, but it wasn't only based on that. But the main thing is to keep in mind is that he was able to institute a policy that dramatically reduced inequality in the country, that dramatically increased the level of education and educational participation in educational systems. So that's on the social level. On a political level, I think what has been very significant, and he didn't need any oil wealth to do this, is to introduce forms of direct democracy through the communal councils, through grassroots participation in all of the social programs, through the creation of communes, where they were given, yes, a budget, but the main point being that they were organized autonomously and able to to become political subjects, essentially. People over and over on, when you interviewed people in the barrios, in the poor neighborhoods, they said, feel like this is the first time that they're participating in a political project and that they're recognized as political subjects, which no government previously had done. So I think those are some of the main gains on a national level. But then there's some other ones that are international, which is such as Chavez and the Bolivarian Revolution really tried to promote regional integration. And so they ended up creating a number of very important institutions that recognize that it's important for countries of the South to come together without the interference or influence of the United States. Particularly, I'm thinking here of the Union of South American Nations, UNASUR, or CELAC, which is the community of Latin American and Caribbean states, both of which have been very essential in terms of trying to resolve problems or issues within each or amongst each other without the interference. It's always been the main problem of the Organization of American States, where Canada and the United States have this completely disproportionate influence and end up basically dominating the entire proceedings. So Chavez really moved towards a new regional integration that created a strong counterpoint, really, to U.S. power. I think that was very crucial.
And Gregory, I think that's a fitting note on which to end. It's been really a pleasure to have you report to us from Venezuela.
It's been my pleasure, too.
Gregory Wilpert, thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Thanks.
Bye.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.